same. I became darker in the process of reading about slavery in Puerto Rico. I began to understand something about me, first of all, but for my readers who write to me and say, oh, I didn't know, I was not taught these in the schools in Puerto Rico, that there was slavery until 1873, that many of them had, like me, a grandparent who was probably a slave. So there's, for me, there's where the hope is, you know. As much as we cry, I mean, we bleed on the computers, trying to bring these issues and these stories and these people to reality, and at the same time, it's changing us, you know.
And this is this issue of the extension of sympathies, Ali. I wonder whether you feel that when you write a book like Native Believe, are you extending other people's sympathies? Are you people who read it, who may come from all sorts of different backgrounds, some of them close to your own, some of them completely removed, couldn't be further removed from you, someone in Scandinavia reading about it, or someone anywhere in the US who doesn't have your cultural background. Do you believe that one of the things you're trying to do, or even doing as a byproduct, is extending sympathy, giving someone a chance to just think for a moment of a world that's other than their own? Because it's hard reading, is really that, it's someone else talking to you directly into your mind, and that's a very strong power. Do you feel that's something you can achieve, or even a method?
I'm not seeking sympathy. I am seeking to educate. I want them to see that, you know, these characters might be black, might be speaking in Spanish, are barefoot and poor, and they feel the same kinds of fears and concerns. They love, they hate, they, you know, they fight, they have sex. I mean, for me, I don't want pity. You know, when you're a poor person, I grew up very, very poor, and that is the most insulting thing that anyone can do to you, is to pity you or condescend or patronize you. So for me, what I'm trying in my work, I'm really trying to introduce somebody, and in fact, I have been, all my books have been published in Scandinavia, to introduce them to people who don't look like them.
Yeah.
But have lives very much, have a lot of the same emotions, you know, and go through a lot of the same kinds of things in a different context. And so hopefully maybe that will change the way that they would look at Geronimo the next time they see him, or the way they see another Puerto Rican or a Pakistani. You know, I hope that they see that from the process of learning that we are the same. So maybe I'm just an optimist, even though I've always thought I'm really kind of a pessimist.
Ali, do you agree with that? Is that what you think, like, that a function that your fiction can and memoir writing can?
Well, I'm interested in what you just said, because we often shock ourselves by our optimism in public spaces, which we do not have when we are in private. And I also wonder if there's a performative element to that, or a representational burden that we take on. And of course, like, that's always why I intend to withdraw into myself, because I feel that I've suddenly created this schizophrenia in myself, and I've justified it through this notion of larger than myself, of responsibility to the people, what people, right? Like Geronimo said, the people that have sustained a, you know, system, a machine that turns in different ways and makes you think that the only way that you can ever be free is to be outside of it, you know? And then it even closes those doors. So that's why I chuckled at what you said when she said, I surprised myself, because I do, so I didn't really follow your question, but I think that was
I think that empathy is certainly literature's great work. You know, and I feel you on the schizophrenia, and I think that was just one thing I said I wasn't going to try to do today. I had to, like, remind myself not to be a friggin' schizophrenic when I came here today, because we're in this place where most of what you're doing as a writer is you're pre-processing a lot of emotions and a lot of ugly truths and trying to make them available to a reader in a way that that reader can actually handle. In a way that that reader can actually understand. And so, you know, that can then kind of bleed out into your behaviors. The other thing is that people really don't want to hear it. You know, people already have sympathy. I mean, I can go fall down the stairs, someone's going to help me up. You know, people have sympathy. The thing is that you know, do people want to change? Do people have the will to change? I don't know, because racism is a fantastic machine, and it's a hugely profitable technology. It's like one of the most profitable systems of extracting both, like, not just material labor, but like spirit and will and soul from people since the Enlightenment. Who is going to willingly turn that off? Who's like going to go open their safe and say, let's redistribute wealth and power? Who's going to say, let's just, you know, open the keys to the kingdom and let everyone take what they want? Nobody's going to do that.
Well, to take it even one stage further, do you believe that racism is inherent in human nature?
You know, I know that it is apparently inherent in American society and in Western society. And it also seems as though there's like this kind of dangerous connection maybe between a propensity to see divisions or create divisions among people and the way capitalism kind of works, you know? And so I don't know that racism is inherent in human nature, but it does feel that we live in an economic and political system that thrives on fear and inequity and has created a world where it feels impossible to escape that.
And that world has probably been around for a very long time.
It's been around at least since the Enlightenment. I mean, phrenology picked up, died everywhere else, came here and got a whole new life. It got a whole new life here. And so at least in this culture, we have a country that is literally defined on those differences. The thing is, you get rid of racism and you get rid of black people, then you get rid of the space where you have deposited all of your fears and anxieties. You get rid of that, and what are you left with? You're left with yourself. We have a society that is basically structured around the notion of people of color as being the shadow self. You know, you've got to think about how this really operates if you're going to break it down. You got to think about how it really operates and the demands that it makes on all of us. It does so in so many ways of which we are unaware. And the thing is, for some of us, those means and ways it affects us are profitable. And for some of us, they are not. And for those who profit by it, it's hard to expect that they would spontaneously change it.
One thing that struck me, because I come from the land of the canon, which is a dead white male canon, and has been for hundreds of years. I'm interested, all three of you, that when you start out on your literary careers and your continued literary careers, who are the writers, who are the canonical writers or otherwise, who've guided you, sort of shown you the way, started down the road that you're following? And Ali, maybe I'll start with you. When you started writing, who are the authors that are guides for you? I'm quite interested in all three of you on that, actually.
Sure. So, for me, growing up in the United States, but having come to the United States at the age of 9 and having been exposed to other literary traditions, including in Dominica and in Pakistan, is kind of this dual set of literary influences. And from the Indian heritage part of me, the Pakistani part of me, the Urdu literary tradition, particularly the anti-colonial and revolutionary writers, progressive writers of society in the 1930s, eventually, Faz Ahmad Faz, the poet, was a part that has played a role for me. In the United States, black writers and Jewish writers played a significant role. Zora Neale Hurston, Richard Wright, even Booker T. Washington, Malcolm X, and Alice Haley. I remember when I was about to move to the United States in 1991, and we had sold all our possessions, and we were just sitting waiting for our ticket to arrive, and it might have been a little bit earlier. But right around that time, Pakistan TV, which used to only come in from 5 p.m. to 11 p.m., started showing Roots. And the scene that has always stayed with me is the enforced name change from Kunta Kinte to his new name. And as someone who had grown up watching the United States from afar and wanted to move there, because of Full House and Sesame Street and Airwolf and all of these other things, that reality that it was such a massive transgression and injustice that put people that I identified with into the United States was a wake-up call. I immediately understood in some subconscious way that I was not white. And so I came here with some of that awareness kind of built in. So that's sort of how it went for me.
Ms. Brown?
Well, I lived in Puerto Rico until I was 13, so my early education was there, and we were landless peasants, very, very poor, and the authors that we were reading in school were all these poets, Puerto Rican poets, all of whom were wealthy white men who wrote about how wonderful to be in the country with, you know, in the campo, and the jíbaros are just so, you know, they're so colorful and so on and so forth. And so we lived like those people, and I remember very, very distinctly, as a little girl, thinking like, where are those happy jíbaros that these guys are writing about? Where are they? They're not here. But what it did do for me was to look at our lives from another side, really, and the perspective of, you know, there is a certain, you know, this particular culture. As I got older, then I realized it's a very particular culture, enough that it allowed for stories that even somebody who didn't live in that culture appreciated those parts of it. And so when I came to the United States, you know, in Puerto Rico, I was disdained because I was a jíbara. But I came to New York, Brooklyn, not very far from here, actually. I was disdained because I was Puerto Rican. It didn't matter whether I was white, black, anything. I was just Puerto Rican. I was not Natalie Wood in West Side Story. And with that went along the fact that I was, you know, that I was in some way pigmented in a way that was not unexpected for people. And that was a shock for me. But speaking about the literary influences, then when I started to read English, the person who had the biggest influence on me was Langston Hughes. He actually came to my high school, and there were three Puerto Ricans in my department, Performing Arts High School. Everybody else was not Puerto Rican. And so he came to speak at the school, dressed nicely, he's got the suit. I mean, he just looked very, very cool, and was just so nice, you know? And I had never heard of him. You know, I was still learning English, I was still starting. But I ran to the library right after that. I read everything that he had written and learned English through that process. And then I felt, okay, now I understand why I feel the way I do. I am a, you know, 14, 15-year-old Puerto Rican girl who hardly speaks Spanish. He became my hero. And for the longest time, and still is, somebody that I go to because he really said something that I needed to hear, but nobody else was telling me in that way.
I'm really thankful that these answers have unfolded the way they have, because what happens so often when you're a writer of color is you're asked to speak to a canon in order to prove that you're literate. Right. They want your often what people who are trying to promote you will, or the publisher's office might want you to talk about all of the classics that you've read, or how there's some connection between your book and all of these books that I'm just not going to name today. Not a canon, not a canonical text, I hope, comes out of my mouth today. Because what ends up happening is we end up promoting the same thing over and over in a way that starts to feel demeaning, because it feels like you're being forced to legitimize yourself. Right, all of these discussions become ways of proving that you're also human. And so there's this burden that you're under to constantly prove that you're human. So I would say the authors that they have named already, I would add to it someone like Percival Everett, who I think has contributed a lot to contemporary American letters. And I'm willing to stop there. Nothing. I'm not going to mention anything from the canon, but I did go to grad school. Twice.
I have this book of best American poetry or something along those lines from 1960, and there's nobody in there that's not white, and I is always near me, as a reminder that that's the canon, so fuck the canon. Something you have to make your own. And one thing that I really do admire about some of the authors that you named, Langston Hughes, Ursula Everett, Ralph Ellison, there's one thing about America's literary scene that England doesn't have, nobody has it, and the reason that the Europeans don't ever give it respect is because they're white. And that is that we have a group of men and women that learned to read and write a language that wasn't their own in a country in which they weren't free, and they came up with words to identify their oppression that are now used for independence movements and liberation movements for the last 150 years. So if the question raised by the Europeans is what is American literature, the reason that they can't answer that question is because they don't look at what really is American literature, and that's literature written by people of color.
I don't want to hog all the questions here, because it's a very full room of people, and they're getting a tremendous chance to hear some really interesting answers. So if you've got questions that you'd like to pose, please do that. Are we going to hand the microphone around? So wait for the microphone, and just please ask away.
Yeah. This is not really a question, but a comment. Adrenaline, a phrase that struck me when you said this side of the page. And I just want to say that you guys have so much courage, because it's not just race that you're dealing with, but the private and public self. And each of you has your own just cross to bear. Just your name, Geronimo, is the old Native American thing, which we haven't even talked about. And that's a whole other world, and I know something about it. And I know that Esmeralda is not just dealing with her own stories, but the prejudice against Puerto Ricans, sports fans, prostitutes, criminals. You know, you have to overcome all that to get to a higher level. And of course, the Muslims, you know, that get in a bad rap, and you represent them. So I just want to say you guys are tremendous, and I applaud your courage, and I appreciate it. And it's very
interesting. Well, that's a lovely thing to say. Let me turn it into a question, because you talk about the public-private sphere. How much do you feel you are giving of yourself, you need to give of yourself in order to be a writer? And is it a price you're always willing to pay? Are there moments, you know, Ali, you were saying you withdrew effectively from society. Is there a moment where you think this is too much of a price to pay because I'm putting myself out there in a very raw state sometimes, and that's a tough thing to do?
I'm the elder here. I am the senior citizen here. I was very, very private for a very, very, very long time. And I became a public person, a writer, when I became a mother and realized that my children needed to know something about their mother that this culture was not telling them. And so it was a terrifying prospect. I had never told anyone just how poor we had been. Our family doesn't sit around talking about how poor we were and welfare and all that stuff, you know. It was, and having to reveal these kinds of things that you have placed way, way in the back of your mind because you don't want to relive those kinds of things. It was difficult, but for me it was so important because nobody else was going to tell my now 36-year-old and 30-year-old daughter. Nobody else was going to tell them these stories because nobody would, you know, they were born in the United States. They just were not hearing this. And so for me, it's hard. I mean, you know, you're by yourself most of the time working, you know, unless you were working at a coffee shop or something. But, you know, you're there crying and laughing and really, you know, having all the emotions that you're hoping to convey to your reader. And then there is that, we have all used the word burden. There is a burden on all of us because of the way we look, because whatever our backgrounds are and the generations that we're from. It's something that we choose to choose, I think, but I think if we didn't have to do this, most of us would not. It took me an hour to dress for you guys. I mean, I look like this every day. for you guys, it's different. But you know, for a woman, it's like, it's a big deal, you know, the high shoot, low shoot, you know, it's really not easy. And so I would really much rather had been in my office crying over my characters than doing this. But on the other hand, I just hope one of you might come out of here and run to the library and find Langston Hughes and have him speak to you the way he spoke to me.
Do you remember when we were walking here, you talked about being a writer, and it's a kind of compulsion. I wonder if the same for you, Ali, as well, that you know, you wouldn't necessarily choose this, and there are upsides as well as downsides and the burden that you've talked about. Do you feel that ultimately it is a compulsion? It is something that you are, that's what you have to do. It's a sort of integral part of who you are.
You know, it does feel like that. There's certainly a duty to speak, to use the voice that you, that in this case I may have by virtue of where I am in society. But you know, in terms of the giving of the self, I was when I was working on my first book, which was about a vet from the conflict in Afghanistan, I remember reading like thousands of pages of first person accounts, right? And viewing films, viewing documentaries, and basically what you're doing as a writer in these cases is sort of acting like a filter, so you're kind of collecting all of this unpleasant stuff and then trying to arrange it into a narrative that's then accessible to another human being that they can kind of unpack in a way that makes sense and might work on their heart. And it's difficult because, not necessarily because of that, not like, oh, I'm so tired, I wrote all day, but because, like, how do you do it well, and how do you write about oppression or injustice without recreating it? And this happened even in the comment, the first comment we have. This first comment includes, in the middle of it, a whole list of things that are essentially disparaging remarks about people of color. Now, you wrapped it in an opening, in a closing that contextualized it, but this is kind of a novel like that writ small. How do you manage that type of material? Because if you don't include it in the book, then you're being aspirational, or you're sort of denying the reality. But when you do include it in the book, then you are also, to some extent, replicating and multiplying the suffering, right? And so I think this is where like the work comes in. Of trying to write about the pain without creating yet more pain.
Another question we've got. I'll get as many as I can until we kick out.
When you envision the race in your ideal reader, do you envision a race that, like, when you're writing, what's the makeup of the person you're writing for?
Just in case you didn't hear the mic, I'll pick it up. Do you envisage a reader when you're writing of a particular racial origin or not?
Of course. Black people already know what I have to say. So I'm not envisioning a black person at the other end of the reading experience, only as sort of an observer or like a guardian angel, you know, because it's going to take me a book maybe to make something like this emotional conversion accessible maybe to a white person. To a black person, I could probably just pick up the phone and say, guess what happened? They're going to believe me.
Is that the same for you, Ali? Is this a notion that you're almost, is it converting or just trying to get people to recognize a different perspective in what you're doing?
I'm probably more skeptical. I don't think that my book will ever see the light of day because it won't be allowed to see the light of day. So I just write for myself and I don't even imagine anybody else. And that's something, not because it's a romantic thing to believe in, but because that was my experience. And if I at that moment had started reconverting my words for a particular audience, then maybe I would have started pandering or changing and mutating what I had originally said, and perhaps it would not be as honest. So the goal is to get it out without changing it for somebody's benefit. And you do that by the skill that you acquire, the craft that you have, and that is hard. That's why we're crying and, you know, griping and in pain at the end of the day. But I don't think the question of audience plays a central role.
Esmeralda, do you want to answer it quickly, and then if we have one more person who wants to speak from over there?
I always feel like I'm writing for other Puerto Ricans, because I think that they understand the shorthand that I use in my... because I write in English, and I write in English and I use some Spanish words in it, but I think that they get the shorthand, so it's not like any one person. I'm really speaking to my whole island and the ones here. Because I think they need to hear these stories. They're not sitting there writing like I am. I have the privilege of doing it, and so I write for them.
That would be the last question, Sandy.
First, writing Puerto Ricans as well, though. I'm right here. Thank you very much. I'm a high school teacher in Jersey, and I serve a population of multi students of color. I'm very, very lucky to get on some of I have a question for Esmeralda, but I would love to hear all perspectives. What sort of spaces were the most conducive to your growth as a writer of color? One thing that I have to constantly do with my work is try to undo and absence unlearn this notion that white male marriage is the most important thing. I'm trying to figure out what sort of space I can create for them, and outside of just like the literary influences, because I try to bring as many writers of color as possible, what were things that helped you kind of validate your own stories?
Oh, that's a really thank you for listening. You know, I had to give up a lot of the things, a lot of my own assumptions. The person who discovered me as a writer is a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant from Boston whose family has been there for 300 years, who I would never in a million years would have met in any other way except that she read one of my essays and got in touch with me. So I had to read this letter that I received from this total stranger and not be suspicious and afraid and think, oh, she's gonna steal all my ideas. I mean, I approached it from a poor person that's constantly being put upon, you know. And so I had to allow myself to trust this person. And it is not easy. It is not an easy thing to do. And it was not easy for me. But I think for our young people, I think that's part of the lesson, is that there's a point in which where you value yourself enough to trust somebody who sounds, you know, who sounds like they're real, and give them a chance. And I gave her a chance, and, you know, when I was Puerto Rican, was born. I don't think I would have done that book on my own. I was not a writer. I just wrote essays for, you know, the local paper. I mean, that was one of the things, is just to be open, you know, just to be open. And if somebody gets in touch with you, or if somebody reads your material and says something nice, they might actually mean it. You know, just don't think, oh, that was shit. You know, I don't like it. Nobody says, thank you, and just be grateful.
Guys, is there any moment for you in the beginning of your career where you felt you were given encouragement, or you found a place that thought, I'm able to do this. This is going to be where I'm going.
My first workshop was at Hurst and Wright, and so it was all writers of color. You know, after that, I did some time at ASU, some time at Stanford. Then I went to the Iowa Writers Workshop, and I was typically the only person of color in all of those environments. And the first experience gave me the energy to get going, but then once I found myself the only black guy with, like, in a room full of liberals, this is when it actually became more apparent to me that it was urgent, you know, and that I needed to find a way to reach people who thought they knew what was going on, but actually don't.
That's interesting. And we haven't been glared at by various people. Ali, last words to you then, because you said you actually withdrew from society at a point where you felt mistrustful of its motivations towards you. Was there a moment that sort of brought you home again?
Well, when I was 20 and I legitimately, threw myself into writing, or at least I thought I wanted to be a writer, the place that I went to was hip-hop, cypher in a cafe where we were just, it was all black, and we would just work on verse. And I suck at rapping, and so I would just sit there and listen, and I would be just writing while they would be, talking and just freestyling. And that, while I couldn't replicate the verbal skills, I knew that I could put them on the page, and that gave me kind of a feeling of confidence, which then I, took into my room and office and so forth.
Well, listen, guys, thank you so much for really sharing all of your experiences, and please join me in thanking our fine panel. I just let you know they're all now signing their books at the imaginatively titled Signing Table A in the Borough Hall Rotunda, so you can go and buy their books and have them signed.